This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. Researchers at Murray State University in Kentucky released a pair of studies that found illicit substances in some water sources in the region. One study profiled contamination in wastewater and river waters. The other estimated consumption rates during special events. Corey Sharber of member station WKMS reports.
Sewage epidemiology is not a term that comes up every day. The somewhat new method of study draws samples of wastewater from treatment plants and water from creeks and streams. Those samples are analyzed in order to detect contaminants and serve as a before and after picture for how the water is treated. Researchers from Murray State University are using sewage epidemiology to determine rates of drug consumption in the West Kentucky region in real time.
This is a relatively new approach that utilizes the level of these illicit drugs in wastewater to back calculate the consumption of all these drugs, you know, different varieties of drugs in community.
That's Dr. Bikram Sabedi, the study's lead author. He's conducted research using this method also in New York. Multiple European countries, including Italy and the UK, also use sewage epidemiology to discover trends in drug abuse. He says the opioid crisis that's been making waves across the country inspired the research.
Lots of the socioeconomic problems in our communities are directly related with this drug consumption. And the conventional estimation of these drugs takes pretty long time. But our technique can give you the data like next day. Within a few hours, we can report the data.
Sabedi's team found their samples contained levels of methamphetamine and amphetamine that contain with some of the highest recorded amounts in the U.S. Sabedi goes as far to say they are the highest in the country. This study focused on the detection of illicit substances. While Sabedi wouldn't reveal the exact locations of the sampling, he says the communities observed varied in their drug use.
What we found is these illicit drugs like cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, amphetamine, methadone, they were significantly high in one community versus another one.
Sabedi says wastewater samples collected from two treatment plants in Western Kentucky reveal that holidays tend to elevate the use of illicit drugs. The study focused on the consumption rates in two communities during special events.
So what we found was a significantly higher concentration of drug consumption during the solar eclipse, during the Independence Day. But we did not find significant difference of all of those drugs in the first week of semester.
Kentucky Department for Environmental Protection spokesperson Lanny Brannick says that thousands of people traveling to the region for the solar eclipse could have contributed to the spike in use.
It was looking at the water during the period of the eclipse. So the question seemed to be, were people en masse in that part of Kentucky where the eclipse was a complete and total eclipse, basically getting high and watching the eclipse?
Brannick says despite the findings, the Kentucky Department for Environmental Protection is not required to monitor illicit substances.
You're looking at something that we don't really test for. It's not our obligation. It's not on our radar necessarily to test for illicit substances in the water.
Caitlin Foppy is a student and assisted with the studies. She says the results from the study should be concerning.
Maybe the drug use is more than what we've been seeing with conventional methods. Nobody wants to see that there's a big drug abuse problem in their communities. You'd like to think that, you know, your communities are safe.
Similar research has found that fish and aquatic ecosystems are affected by the presence of drugs in water. Sabedi says chronic exposure led to reduced reproductive output and induced gene expression that mimics human profiles of people diagnosed with autism.
These drugs were designed to be effective, and they are already there. Every day, it's not one day, 2 days, every day they're in the system. So basically all those aquatic organisms are being chronically exposed to these drugs.
If they are affecting the fish, they could also be affecting humans. The studies were published in Science of the Total Environment. The Murray State researchers plan to expand their sewage epidemiology research towards larger communities outside of the region. I'm Corey Sharber in Murray.
America and Iran used to be close allies. But since the Iranian Revolution began in 1979, the relationship has been akin to a bad divorce. The latest chapter, President Trump's announcement to pull the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal. All this has Trey Kay, host of West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Us and Them podcast, thinking about the us and them dynamic between these two countries. Trey has a friend, Essa Zahedi, who helped him think of Iranians as something other than the enemy. Here's an excerpt of from the latest Us and Them podcast, Love, the Ayatollah, and Revolution.
I don't know about you, but I didn't think about Iran much until 1979. That's when a group of college students who supported the Iranian Revolution seized the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and held 53 American diplomats and citizens hostage.
At the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, it is now Tuesday morning. Islamic religious leaders and Tehran radio...
I remember Ted Koppel on TV giving a daily update of what was happening. The whole thing played out over 444 days. Talk about a foreign government having a hand in a U.S. election. The whole ordeal dogged Jimmy Carter's re-election bid. And Iran released the hostages the very hour Ronald Reagan was sworn in as president.
I, Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
The Algerian aircraft carrying the hostages have left Tehran. The American hostages finally are on their way.
Ever since then, there's been an us-and-them relationship between America and Iran that has ebbed and flowed up through today. More recently, President Obama took a keep-your-friends-close-and-your-enemies-closer kind of approach, joining the European Union, China, and Russia to try to avoid a dangerous scenario.
The United States, together with our allies and partners, has reached a historic understanding with Iran, which, if fully implemented, will prevent it from obtaining a nuclear weapon. As president and commander-in-chief, I have no greater responsibility than the security of the American people. And I am convinced that if this framework leads to a final comprehensive deal, it will make our country, our allies, and our world safer.
President Trump made it clear he is far less trusting. Not long after he was inaugurated, he issued an executive order barring immigration from 7 countries, including Iran. Iranian officials countered by barring Americans from entering their country. And earlier this month, President Trump made good on a promise that he hammered again and again during the 2016 presidential campaign and pulled out of that multinational deal.
The Iran deal is defective at its core. If we do nothing, we know exactly what will happen. In just a short period of time, the world's leading state sponsor of terror will be on the cusp of acquiring the world's most dangerous weapons. Therefore, I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
In the days leading up to the president's announcement, I thought a lot about my friend Essie and his family, and how knowing them has given me a more nuanced understanding of Iranian people. Certainly there have been actions by the Iranian government over the past 40 years that should concern all Americans. But the way President Trump speaks about Iran reduces the majority of the people in that nation to scary boogeyman caricatures. Knowing Essie, I understand that the story is much more complex. So today, in the wake of the U.S. scrapping the Iran nuclear deal, we thought it might be nice to revisit an Iranian us-and-them love story that we produced last year. We call it Love, the Ayatollah, and Revolution. My friend Essie, short for Esach, a derivation of Isaac, was born in Shahsavar, Iran in 1942. Starting back in 1977, he witnessed the transformation of Iran into the Islamic Republic of Iran.
In the beginning of so-called revolution, there was no talk of overthrowing the regime. When it started, there was some political oppression by the government, the Shah. But socially, there were a lot of freedom. People could do anything. And, you know, even you could criticize the government, but not the Shah himself.
So in case you're confused or don't know much about the history of Iran, it was a monarchy led by a Shah, Persian for king. Shah Reza Pahlavi had ruled since 1941. He was mostly secular and succeeded in modernizing Iran through economic and social reforms. He was also considered one of America's closest allies in the region. At a 1977 state dinner in Tehran, President Jimmy Carter toasted the Shah.
Iran, because of the great leadership of the Shah is an island of stability in one of the more troubled areas of the world.
Though it might have seemed tranquil from Carter's perspective, the Shah's regime was increasingly unpopular.
When I was in college, there were a lot of abuse of power by the Shah's regime. Any kind of protest by the student or intellectuals, then this SAVAK, which was the secret service of the Shah, got involved and oppressed. Everything was considered political. Even you had objection against the quality of food in cafeteria. Then the police SAVAK got involved.
SAVAK was the Shah's secret police and were notorious for imprisoning and torturing the Shah's political opponents. Essie says SAVAK's abuses on the public were among several factors that led to the revolution. Another factor was the Grand Ayatollah Khomeini, whom the Shah had exiled in 1964. Khomeini was living in Paris and continued to condemn the Shah's regime.
The Iranian students in America and also in Europe, they were supporting Khomeini based on his promises in Paris that he's not going to become a leader in Iran. He's not going to get involved with the politics or ruling the country.
Once the Shah had fled Iran, Khomeini was free to return home. He pledged that he would act as a guide to the politicians. After all, he was a cleric, not a statesman. But in February 1979, Khomeini disembarked from an Air France 747 and set foot on his homeland. The revolution was still evolving, both in terms of who would run the country and how much freedom it would have. The Ayatollah and his clerics began framing an Islamic constitution, which informed nearly every aspect of life in Iran. Ayatollah Khomeini was now the supreme leader and would no longer tolerate dissent in the name of freedom. Here he is in August 1979, delivering a message which seemed to be aimed at my friend Essie.
Our writers are either ignorant or traitors. These so-called Democrats who say the country should be free and you should under no circumstance restrict any freedoms, they are inspired by superpowers and want to plunder us and want our youths to be indifferent. We want to protect the country, and protecting the country is impossible with the freedoms you talk about. These freedoms will destroy the country.
Despite this new crackdown on the press, Essie was miraculously released from prison, narrowly avoiding execution for his publications. He literally felt like he dodged a bullet. But was he a marked man?
I had some friends within the government who informed me that extremists, those people who are more revolutionary, more aggressive, are going after all those people they think that are potentially counter-revolutionary. So they may come after you. So that's why I got the signal that I should leave the country.
Essie risked life and limb to make his way out of Iran. His motivation for leaving wasn't just politics, religion, or fear for his safety. A major reason was to be with the American woman who captured his heart. To hear Crazy Love Story, part of Essie's saga, download the Us and Them podcast from iTunes, Stitcher, NPR One, or Public Radio. You can also listen online at wvpublic.org. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.